Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello and welcome to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Tom Holland, who's an award-winning historian, author, and broadcaster. His most recent book is Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind, which is now available in paperback. It covers the 2,000 years since Jesus Christ, and it explores the extent to which Christianity has shaped our worldview, whether we believe in his divinity or not. So don't be put off, because today's podcast is about so much more than just religion. It's really about how we make sense of the big cultural issues of our day. Hope you enjoy the show. So I was introduced to your book, Dominion, while I was in Los Angeles last year, this time last year, actually, and I bought a copy of the book. I couldn't help notice that in the UK, it's called Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind. In the US, my copy is called Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. Why is there that distinction there?
I think it sums up quite a lot of differences towards Christianity between Britain and America.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah, no, my editor in Britain is, I think, quite suspicious of organized religion. And right. That combined with, I think, a sense he had that any mention of God or Jesus or crosses on the cover of books tends subliminally with the great British bookbuying public to make them think it's going to be a kind of work of apologetics.
I see.
And that it would then be ghettoized in the kind of religious section of the bookshops. So that's what he absolutely didn't want. So the cover is not just the subtitle, it's the cover as well, certainly of the hardback. I don't think there's a single hint on it that has anything to do with Christianity at all.
My copy has this Salvador Dali image of Jesus, clear.
America, it's full on. It's Jesus. He's on a cross. It's the Christian Revolution. Woo. Whereas in England, I think there's a single discrete cross hidden inside the O of Dominion.
A subliminal cross.
Yes. And that was kind of basically because I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, you know, it's a book about Christianity. You've got to have some suggestion of what it's about. But on the paperback, it's a kind of Sgt. Pepper style montage of different aspects of what's right. in the book. But again, it was, there was almost nothing Christian in the first run through. It was all kind of, I think there was Hitler and if it right. died, Chuck Hitler on the front.
Isn't that quite revealing? That's quite revealing, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, I would have thought, to be honest, having read the book, that the phrase, how the Christian Revolution remade the world, is closer to what the book is about.
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. Yeah.
And does that suggest that, I mean, Jesus, well, I suppose Jesus just doesn't sell over here. I guess that's the truth of it.
I think that not much is written about it that is aimed at the kind of mainstream bookselling market.
Right.
I think that's what it is. And so I think that it's just kind of part of the semiotics of publishing that anything with Jesus on the cover is a work of apologetics.
Because you're not preaching, you're not sermonizing. That's not what this book is about.
No, not at all. It's a work of history. But I mean, I think it is fascinating about how invisible institutional organized Christianity has become in this country. That people who you know, the commanding heights of our literary culture are just very kind of nervous of it.
Fair enough. Although the Bible has been quite a good bestseller, to be fair. So
it has, but that's exactly it. You get a Bible from the corner of the shop that's selling Bibles.
You do. You know, that's true.
That's the whole point.
Yes. So or you steal a Gideon's Bible from the hotel.
Yeah, but if your book ends up next to the section that's selling Bibles, then it's only going to be bought by the kind of people who want to buy a Bible. Whereas I wanted to sell this to people you know, it's not just for Christians. I mean, it's, you know, if anything, it's for people who aren't Christian.
I actually quite liked the way you've embedded Christianity in it in a subtle way. I like the structure, for instance. Let's talk a bit about the structure, because you don't have to be a numerologist to see what you're doing there. There's three parts to the book. Each part has seven chapters, and each chapter has three sections. So you're doing the 3, 7, 3, and the numbers 7 and 3, as we know, are very significant in Christianity. Is that something you were deliberately trying to? Well, obviously,
yes, of course, absolutely. Because the book covers 2,500 years of history, so that's an insanely vast sweep. So there's no way that I could hope to cover everything. And also, it's not a history of Christianity; it's a history about what's made Christianity radical and transformative and revolutionary over the course of the millennia. So I thought the only way that I can cope with this is to invoke, as you say, Christian symbolic numerology. And the Trinity, you know, so 3 was huge. And the idea that there have been 3 ages is a kind of key feature of medieval thought.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are the 3 ages. And then 7, of course, is again a key number.
Yes.
Sacraments and the cities that John writes to in the book of Revelation, and the sins and the virtues and all that kind of stuff. So I thought that it was a way of imposing a kind of structure on what would otherwise just be a completely inchoate mass of stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's what history is basically, is kind of organizing stuff into a way that it makes sense.
And actually, the way you've approached it is very interesting. And it is a shame, in a way, if non-Christians don't read this, because this pertains to absolutely everyone, because your central idea is that all of our culture is underpinned by Christianity, whether we like it or not, or whether we know it or not.
Pretty much everything. Yes. But yes, absolutely. And I guess the argument would be that people who feel so opposed to Christianity or to religion generally that they don't want to read anything about it are themselves, that their hostility is in itself kind of bred of Christian motives. That their hostility to Christianity has a kind of Christian shape to it. And,
yes.
And that absolutely is part of the argument. So that is very much why I was happy to go along with what my editor, who's a brilliant editor, who completely knows the market, who absolutely knows what he's doing, when he said, let's not put too much Jesus on the cover. I mean, you know, because I absolutely didn't want it ghettoized into a kind of religious market.
That makes sense. And it's very interesting what you say there about even the condemnation of itself is a kind of, has a kind of Christian basis. There's actually a line which I wrote down deliberately because I thought this was interesting. You said any condemnation of Christianity as patriarchal and repressive derived from a framework of values that was itself utterly Christian. I think some people are going to need some help with that concept. Do you want to just talk us through how that can be?
I mean, that opens up a huge can of worms, the issue of, for instance, patriarchy, which is, of course, what everyone, particularly feminists, associate with Christianity. The idea of God as a guy with a white beard in the sky, popes and Catholic priests and so on. But the issue is, and this is something that's been picked up recently by a guy whose name I can't remember, who's at Harvard, and the book is called Weird. And it's essentially about how the distinctive family structure in the West is founded on kind of church canons, which is in Dominion as well. And it reflects the startling degree to which our assumptions about how families should be organized, how men and women should meet, how they should form families, is absolutely rooted in the history and the theology of Christianity.
Yes.
So for the Romans, a familia is the entire household. It's the kind of kinship group. It's the slaves. It's the dependents. And in that society, the guy at the top, the male citizen, essentially can do what he like. I mean, he can use his slaves. He can use his dependents pretty much any way he likes sexually.
Mm-hmm.
And he has right of formally of life and death over his children. So he can make them marry who he wants. And so it's important to keep things in literally in the family.
Yes.
The son, the daughter doesn't really have much choice over who he or she is going to marry. And there's nothing unusual about this. This is pretty much taken for granted across most civilizations in most periods. But what's distinctive about the Christian civilization that emerges is that this is not taken as normative. And at its profoundest, it's rooted in Paul's letters, which are the earliest Christian texts we have, where he is essentially wrestling with the idea of what is an acceptable sexual relationship. And he says, basically, the only acceptable model is the love that Christ feels for his church. and the man is modeled on Christ, and the church is the woman. And so therefore there's an incredible sacrality about the, you know, what that relationship should be. So the idea that a man and a woman should marry, that they should choose one another, that this should then be monogamous and that it should be for life, all of these very, very radical, weird kind of assumptions when pushed together to create this kind of nexus for marriage. And the implication of it is that, first of all, that if the man is modeled on Christ, then that means he can't go around kind of, you know, sodomizing the page boy or forcing himself orally on the slave girl or whatever else he wants to do with his slaves. You know, he has to treat every human being, their body is sacral because it's created in the image of God. And so you have to show respect for that. And so therefore, the Roman slave owner has to be like everyone else. He's like Christ. He has to marry a woman and he has to respect her as Christ respects his church. But the further implication of that, which is then kind of teased out over the centuries that follow and is enshrined by the kind of the canons of the church over the course of late antiquity into the Middle Ages, is that it's unacceptable for clan lords, for patriarchs to tell their sons and their daughters that they have to kind of marry one another. And so the church becomes absolutely neurotic about incest, which it prescribes in a very, very strict way, kind of up to 7 degrees of separation. And essentially they're saying you can only marry people who are in law. So that's where our whole idea of in-laws comes from. And ultimately, the implication of this is that if a patriarch can't force, one cousin to marry another cousin, then ultimately it's up to the male and the female to choose one another. And so from that, you start to get the idea of romantic love as the basis for marriage. And then, in due course, for more than marriage. The work of literature, of course, that expresses this most powerfully and enduringly is Romeo and Juliet, because the Capulets and the Montagues are classic patriarchs. You know, they're telling Juliet who she's got to marry. Romeo's got to marry. But Romeo and Juliet want to marry one another. And who is it marries them? It's the friar.
So while Christianity cements this this patriarchal structure that you're talking about, at the same time, in what you've just said, it implies very strongly that it's pushing back against a sense of injustice, and it's also urging a sense of respect for the weaker members of society, or the more vulnerable members of society, you know, the blessed are the meek narrative. So in a sense, to take the example of feminism, the way in which feminists push back on Christianity is saying it is an oppressive patriarchal structure. That could be said to be Christian insofar as that they are trying to look out for the underdogs. Is that a way of looking at it?
I was writing Dominion and aware that the sexual revolution of the 60s was kind of hanging over the thesis, and that this was going to be a problem. And because clearly since the 60s, society has become incredibly sexualized in a way that overtly seems to be very opposed to Christianity. And I was kind of thinking, I'm just going to put my hands up and say, yeah, okay, you know, this is where it falls down. And I do think that the 60s do mark a really radical break. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I think the 60s is up there with basically the kind of the 1520s as a reconfiguration of what we might once have called Christendom, the West. But if we place what it was that people in the 60s were doing, so when they said all you need is love, and if by love they meant sexual love, then essentially for men in particular, that kind of became a license for having sex with anyone, anyway, anyhow you liked, in a way that would have really appealed to a Roman slave owner, for instance.
It would.
And a lot of the 60s counterculture was kind of absolutely expressed, you know, in the Dionysic terms. You know, let's get rid of this oppressive sanctimony, these blue meanies telling us what we can't do. Let's get back to the good old days when Greek gods could rape whoever they wanted, was subliminally the message. I mean, that's not how they put it, but that's kind of, you know, as we, you know, we're recording this day after Phil Spector died. I mean, that this was part of the kind of the darker dynamic of 60s liberation was this sense that it kind of greenlit a form of predatory sexuality that Christian morality had always sought to control and restrain. Now, what also enabled that, I think, was, again, a very Christian movement, which was the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement was absolutely rooted in Christian assumptions, the Reverend Martin Luther King. I mean, kind of goes without saying. And Martin Luther King's arguments to white Christians were deeply founded on exactly what you said, the idea that the first should be last, the last should be first, that you should care. Those who are wealthy should care for those who have nothing. Mm-hmm. But it's also rooted, of course, in the broader sense that all human beings fundamentally created in the equally in the image of God, and therefore all are charged with a kind of essential dignity. And that therefore it's incumbent on those with privilege to recognize those who lack it and to treat them as brothers and sisters. And this was so powerful and so readily accepted by white Christians that the civil rights movement was hugely successful and transformed American politics.
Well, isn't that the point, that it's that it is persuasive? Isn't the point that it is persuasive if you're coming from a genuinely sincerely Christian mindset?
Yes, completely.
And if you're going off the back of scripture, this is an indisputable...
Yes.
I mean, I know that there's a part of the book where you talk about slavery specifically, and you talk about how slavery was never really compatible with Christian teaching at any point. You had to kind of fudge it to make it work.
Well, we'll come to slavery in a minute, but just to stick to the 60s and how that then impacted the sexual revolution. Because what I think then happened in the 60s was that the model of civil rights campaigning that Martin Luther King and his followers had kind of exemplified got taken up by other people who historically had been oppressed. So women, gay yes. people, and so on. And they essentially took over the package and pushed it through. But of course, women saying that women should be equal to men, that did seem to attack assumptions that were fairly hardwired into Christian thinking. And
right.
gay liberation even more so. And so what happened in the decades that followed the 60s was that there was a kind of splintering, and you had people who were overtly doctrinally practicing Christians on one side, and you had those who came to see Christianity as patriarchal, oppressive, homophobic, sexist, whatever, on the other. But both sides were absolutely taking for granted some fairly key principles, namely that all people are basically equal, that those who are oppressed should not be oppressed, that those who are weak have a kind of call on those who are strong. And it's just that the way that those understandings have been interpreted have kind of splintered
yes.
cultures across the West, but particularly in America. But then what happened when I was writing it was the Harvey Weinstein thing in the Me Too movement. And suddenly, again, I've got it in the book, it's one of the photographs, is the protesters on the Women's March, where they're all dressed up as handmaids from the TV adaptation of the novel. And that's a piss take of Puritanism. I mean, it's, you know, on the godly Commonwealth founded by the Pilgrim Fathers. But of
yes.
course, what women were demanding was that men behave like Puritans in the best sense, that they exercise
yes.
self-control and continence, and that they don't just kind of, you know, jump people and force themselves on them, that they respect women and respect the kind of integrity of their bodies, the sanctity of their bodies. And it seems to be kind of perfect exemplification of the paradoxes, the kind of Möbius strip of our
yes.
complicated nature.
It's so complex. I mean, that's a fascinating tension, isn't it? Because insofar as you tend to associate the kind of oppressive norms with a kind of Christian fundamentalist worldview, but at the same time, the most fundamentalist interpretation of Christianity would see those norms disintegrated.
Yeah.
It is a fascinating tension.
It completely, yeah.
That's why it's very important that obviously all of this builds from the example of Jesus Christ and the iconography of Jesus Christ. And the argument you make very strongly, of course, is that he is the ultimate victim. He, for once, you're rooting for the victim, I suppose. Let's put it that
but
way.
But also the conqueror.
But also the conqueror, right.
He's the victim who conquers.
Exactly, exactly. And this is why you're right. So you have this spectre in the book of Nietzsche, who, of course, hates this idea
yes.
of a weak hero. It,
yes.
it's seen as incoherent. But yeah, I mean, maybe could you talk to us a bit about that? About the, because I mean, I think your argument is very much putting forward that how radical actually this is.
Completely radical.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely radical. I mean, what's radical about the figure of Christ is not that it's a mortal becoming a god, because they're two a penny. There are lots of them. And a very famous one is the object of the fastest growing cult in the first century AD. It's not Christianity, it's the cult of Augustus, whose birth is surrounded by miracles, who is the son of a god, namely Julius Caesar, who brings a new age of peace to the world, who, when he dies, ascends to heaven and is seated at the right hand of his father. But, you know, Augustus is the emperor of Rome. He's a warlord.
Oh, he's a tyrant.
He's not just a tyrant, but I mean, no, he is recognizably a guy who should become a god. He's very, very powerful. You know, he's going with the flow of everything that people assume.
Yes.
Whereas Jesus is a guy who suffers the most humiliating death imaginable. And crucifixion is a death that is visited on rebels against Roman power in the provinces and slaves who rebel against their masters. So it's the worst fate that you can have, because it's not just painful, it's not just protracted, but it's publicly humiliating. Yes. That's why it's the fate for slaves. You're nailed up and you're like a slab of meat on a cross and everyone laughs at you. People, you know, watch it, birds peck out your eyes, and it's all a great joke. Whereas for Christians to turn around and say, actually, this guy, you know, this is the guy who's at the right hand of God the Father.
Yeah.
And the slave has triumphed over the master, the weak has triumphed over the strong, the tortured has triumphed over the torturer. And that sets in train a vast kind of depth charge beneath the culture of the Roman Mediterranean that ripples outwards and is still rippling out now, as I don't need to tell you of all people, because you are expert at exploring the contradictions and the paradoxes and basically the humour of the situation that arises from an idea that in weakness there is strength.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. I think you're right. It's such a comfort to me that this kind of God wins out in the end, that the old gods died off. I mean, they had to, really, didn't they? Because although they were strong and tyrannical, they were also petty and jealous and subject to tantrums, shall we say.
Yeah, I think it's also that the understanding of what the relationship was of humans to the divine was very different. Mm. I mean, there are lots of things that Christianity absorbs into itself that's percolating around in the Roman Empire when Jesus is alive. But what Christianity does brilliantly is to package it in a way that makes it incredibly accessible and incredibly appealing. And one of the things is the idea that Jesus died for you. Hey, yeah. Scummy slave whose, you know, job is to tread clothes in piss. He died for you.
Yes.
You are created in the image of God, maimed slave laborer in a mine. In fact, the lower you are in a sense, the more God loves you is the kind of implication that's burning away there.
Of course.
And against that, the gods of Greece and Rome are chillier and remoter and aren't really kind of interested in the individual. And that's true of the philosophers as well. So, you know, Aristotle's idea of a kind of prime mover, that's very chilly and remote. You know, this prime mover doesn't give a toss about human beings on the earth.
Yes.
At all. Whereas the God who's come down and has been made human and died, he really does. So that's incredibly powerful. And it electrifies all kinds of philosophical notions and makes them accessible. So one of the great heroes in the book, Origen, the great Alexandrian theologian, he is one of the most brilliant men of his age. I mean, he's absolutely steeped in Greek classical learning, philosophy. I mean, he's an absolute master of it. And yet every so often he will pause and say, wow, this is amazing. You know, God became this little baby and cried for milk. And I just can't comprehend it. I can't understand it. And what part of what overwhelms Origen is the idea that anyone can get that.
Yes.
You know, the slave girl can get that. The person who can't read can get that.
And we just take this for granted now, don't we? Because we're so steeped in it.
Completely, yes.
And I think you're absolutely right to really bring out this idea of the strength and power through weakness. As you say, a lot of the things that I satirize are precisely that paradox. But it also gets me into trouble, because if I'm mocking someone who has generated power or is wielding power from a position of weakness, I then get accused of punching down at the weak. Whereas, of course, what I'm actually doing is the reverse. I'm punching up at who I perceive to have the strength in society and the power in society. So I don't know how we ever reconcile that.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Nietzsche, and of course that is very much Nietzsche's point, that weakness can become a kind of strength.
Yes.
And he, you know, his image of the blonde beast who kind of gets captured by Christianity and tonsured and set in a monastery and just sits there gibbering with weakness. Nietzsche's object of hatred is the people who have weaponized this,
right,
this sense and made it an agency of power for themselves. And that, of course, is again a long running theme throughout the history of Christianity, that Christianity, of course, is founded on the image of a savior who dies the death of a slave, but it very, very rapidly becomes unbelievably powerful. I mean, Christianity, measured over by the span of the past 2,000 years of history, is the most hegemonic way of organizing and framing humanity's purpose that has ever existed. And so to obtain control of it, to obtain a kind of controlling stake in it, is to become incredibly powerful. And that in turn kind of generates ricochet effect, because if people do become too powerful on the commanding heights of the church, then they in turn become objects. They become the kind of people who have to be dragged down. And so you have a new height, you know, a new bout of reform will come and pull them down. And this has been a cycle that's gone on and on throughout Christian history. See it with the emergence of the medieval church, with the Reformation, with the Enlightenment. And I think since the 60s, we've seen a kind of new clerisy, a new people who occupy the commanding heights of what was Christendom. And they would never identify themselves as Christian. I mean, they would often say that Christianity is everything that they're repudiating. But I think that they are still kind of shot through with Christian assumptions, Christian understandings. And part, I think, of what makes many members of this new elite arrogant is precisely that they're not aware of where they stand in the broad sweep of history. And also they're not aware of everything within the specifically Christian message that would kind of encourage a sense of humility and indeed forgiveness.
Yes.
And a recognition that we are all sinners. I mean, that has always been kind of part of the saving grace for Christianity, is that the idea that we are all sinners, that we're all fallen.
Original sin.
Yes. It keeps people honest, because you can never be entirely convinced of your own virtue.
I didn't think you'd be flying the flag for original sin, but okay. I think there's something to it, I suppose.
I think original sin is the most democratic. I mean, obviously, kind of, you know, the idea that a newborn baby is
evil.
Shot through. I mean, my wife's parents were very devout cradle Catholics, and at her baptism, there was all this stuff about the devil and everything and how she'd been born in original sin. And they were so shocked by this idea that they spectacularly left the church in the way that I think only cradle Catholics do.
I can believe it. Babies are bloody annoying. They shout, well, they scream.
For them, it was saying, you know, their little darling, they couldn't bet, you know, the idea that she had original sin was so shocking. So they left and never had anything more to do with it.
But they must know what the baptism is. You're dousing it in holy water.
Yeah, I think it just kind of brought it home. So that is shocking. And that's, you know, that's why basically original sin became this, again, kind of thrown onto the bonfire of the 60s, full-blown kind of Rousseauian idea that we're all, you know, born innocent. But I think it's an incredibly morally democratizing a doctrine, because it means that no one can be convinced that their virtue. And I would guess that is the kind of thing that you satirize, is people who are so convinced of their virtue that they don't recognize the beam in their own eye while pointing out the motes in the eyes of others.
I think it's even worse than that. Yes, that is correct. What frightens me about the real kind of movers and shakers in the social justice ideology, the what we call the woke, is the sheer certainty and lack of humility, this sense in which it's never crossed their mind that they could potentially be wrong. That actually terrifies me, because I think that puts them in a very dangerous position, particularly when they have such cultural clout, which I think brings us to the end of your book, the end of Dominion, which is when you go into this idea of woke and wokeness. Now, it's since that book was published, it has become a kind of commonplace to talk about wokeness as a form of religion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done it myself, and I think that is useful as a kind of accessible analogy. You know, in other words, people taking things on faith without any regard for evidence, right? There's that element to it. But more than that, there's the kind of element of the clerisy, of a body of people who are willing to stand there on above everyone else and say, we know better and you should follow our decree. And I think that's where it comes in. But when it comes to suggesting that this is a kind of has derived from Christianity, there is a tension there, because so many of the same people lack basic compassion, humanity, a belief in redemption, and they don't have that kind of intellectual rigor of the great theologians. They have these foundational texts that they half understand, like Foucault or Derrida, which they don't even read. So it's not really so much a religion as a fundamentalist religion, I suppose, is what I'm saying. What do you think?
I think it's absolutely shot through with the assumptions of Anglo-American Protestantism.
Okay. Can you explain that a bit?
So what's distinctive about Anglo-American Protestantism, as it evolves on both sides of the Atlantic, on the kind of more radical fringes, is the idea that you're given grace. Mm-hmm. So you become part of a spiritual elite. Your heart is opened. The spirit descends. And when the Spirit descends on you, you read the Bible, and it's not the words on the page that matter. It's how the Spirit influences you to interpret the words on the page. Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about slavery. I mean, notoriously in the Bible, there is no condemnation of slavery as an institution. And so that's part of why it takes Christians so long to kind of wake up to the idea that there may be a problem with slavery as an institution.
Yes.
They tend to see it as being like hunger or thirst or inequality.
Yes, yes.
It's just kind of part of what, you know, a fallen world. And it's in the 18th century with the spectacle of racialized slavery that first Quakers, Baptists, evangelicals, people on the kind of hotter, more extreme wing of Protestantism start to say this is unacceptable. And even if it doesn't say it in the Bible, I know that that's right because the Spirit has kind of entered me.
So it's an inner knowledge, a kind of a gnosis, a kind of something that you just intuitively feel.
Yeah. And the power of that is that kind of like a bonfire catching light, this understanding through the 18th century into the 19th century just blazes. And ultimately, you don't have to be Protestant. You don't even have to be Christian to accept it. It's become a kind of universal that now the idea of slavery is just seen as completely wrong. And we sit in judgment on people who, who took it for granted. But unless we recognize how dramatic and spectacular this kind of Protestant understanding of the Spirit and how it enabled them to radically reconfigure people's sense of what was right and proper, we don't have a sense of just how complete the transformation was. Now, another expression of this Anglo-American Protestantism was the idea of awakenings.
Yes.
And these originate in England, spread to America, and it's kind of revivalist. It's a sense, you know, what we're talking about earlier, that society has been corrupted, has been marred in sin. People need to wake up. They need to feel the Spirit. They need to cast off their sin. And you have the succession of what are called great awakenings.
Mm.
And the idea of being woke, the idea of being awakened to, you know, what you are, what society around you is, that's kind of an expression of it. And so the phrase the Great Awakening is kind of, you know, it's irresistible to people. And I think justly so, because I think that it's clearly coming from that kind of that sense. You would, without that kind of seedbed of distinctive Anglo-American Protestantism, it wouldn't kind of take wing. Now, you're right, of course, that it's not Christian. And again, this goes back to the 60s, that the 60s, the civil rights movement was overtly Christian. Martin Luther King could appeal to white Christians and quote the Bible. He could quote the book of Exodus. He could quote the Gospels. He could quote the parables. That's not the case anymore, because now often for people who would see themselves campaigning for social justice, Christianity is part of the problem.
It's one of the grand narratives that they have to deconstruct. It's one of the,
absolutely, yeah,
the power structures.
So what they've inherited is clearly substantial. The idea that there is a Spirit that descends, that opens people's eyes, that enables people to be conscious of their own sin and to be redeemed from it.
Yes.
The summons to other people, the denunciation of sin, the idea most foundationally that those who are oppressed should be raised up, that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, as Christ said. I mean, this is the kind of controlling idea. It's the idea that Nietzsche hated, but which is probably the most radical idea that Christianity teaches. And it's absolutely rooted there. But what's not there are the corollaries, the idea that all of us are sinners, that none of us are completely virtuous. And also that forgiveness is a crucial part of it. And also, I think most fundamentally, the idea that as Paul said, there is no Jew or Greek, there is no man or free, there is no man or woman, there is no slave or free. And ultimately, what is transformational about Christianity is the idea that difference is dissolved, not that it is preserved. And if the rich man is told to give food, to give water, to give clothing, to give shelter to the poor, it's not because the poor are inherently better. It's because ultimately all must be one in Christ. And that, I think, is the sense that's been lost. And it's part of why the churches are kind of now on the opposite side of this cultural divide.
So, but additionally, it does rehabilitate this notion of the existence of evil, that there are evil entities, there are evil, that there's a kind of satanic force in society which needs to be purged. Which, how does that fit in with it? Because I see that all the time. I see, if you rely on this inner knowledge that you've just described coming from the Anglo-Protestant tradition, which doesn't even feel very Protestant to me, because wasn't a key aspect of the Reformation this idea of sola scriptura, going to the text and sourcing everything from the text and not just imagining it for yourself?
No, but it's then how you read it.
Right, okay. But if you do rely on that inner knowledge, that intuition, shall we say, then you don't need to prove your point. You don't need to... You can call someone a Nazi, racist, homophobe, transphobe, whatever, because you just know it to be true. And if you're pushed for evidence, you don't need to pronounce it, or you don't even need to show any evidence. And you can justify dehumanizing, demonizing, and I use that word explicitly because I think that's what they're doing. They're saying this is an evil person who cannot be redeemed. You can't forgive Satan.
Right. I think there's something else that's happened here, which is that since the Enlightenment, I mean, so one of the paradoxes of Christianity is that you can see that that atheism becomes a kind of logical endpoint for it.
Okay.
Because right the way back with the Hebrew prophets, all the way through Christian history, the idea that the gods worshipped by the Babylonians or the Egyptians, they're not real. It's just stock and stone. That springs and trees and groves aren't really supernatural. You know, they're not endowed with a sacral sense. They're just what they seem to be. Mm. And over the course of Christian history, the urge to pull down idols and to banish superstition and to bring people in darkness into light has been a kind of enduring theme. And again, Christians have turned on earlier incarnations of the church. So notorious, you know, I mean, this is what the Reformation is about.
Yes.
That Protestant reformers end up equating Catholics with pagans and their rituals as being kind of satanic, and therefore they have to be exorcised. And what happens in the Enlightenment is that the same thing, artillery starts to be turned against Christianity generally. And a sense of the sacral, a sense of the holy, a sense of the weird, if you like, that kind of dimension of demons and angels and heavenly hosts starts to bleed away. And I think that's sped up over the past century that many Christians, as far as I can tell, and certainly Christian bishops and so on, have become embarrassed about all the supernatural stuff.
Right.
At the same time, in a way, we now have a new, more dynamic, more charismatic model of evil than that of hell and Satan, which is the Nazis and Hitler.
Yes.
Hitler is now the devil. Auschwitz is hell. Nazis are the ranks of the demonic. And I think that it's no coincidence that doctrinal Christianity in the West has fallen off a cliff since the 60s, when people started to wake up to the implications of the Holocaust. Mm. And essentially before the Nazis, even people who weren't practicing Christians, would, if they wanted to know what is good, what's the right thing to do, would say, what would Jesus do? Now people say, what would Hitler do? And then do the opposite.
Right.
And I think that the sense of evil has migrated from Christianity to a kind of an understanding of history, and that the Nazis serve the role that the devils played previously, and that now we locate evil in history and not in Christianity. And I think that churchmen are as embarrassed to talk about devils and the demonic and evil as historians are ready to do it.
But what you're saying is that people need some kind of devil figure, something to hook onto, and hence you get this idea that Nazism is rampant in society, even though it clearly isn't.
Well, I think people in the West do.
Right, okay.
Because I think we've been habituated to the idea of there being good and evil.
Yes.
And demonic entities that can corrupt. You know, this is part of an inheritance that reaches back centuries and millennia. We can't do without it, I think, is what the post-war period teaches us.
But it's interesting what you say about how the history of Christianity, that it always turns on itself or turns on older versions of itself. I mean, yeah. I would compare that to the way in which the woke, you know, I don't even like using the word now because it's become a bit of a cliche, but the way that the woke now turn on the civil rights luminaries, turn on Martin Luther King and say that he suffered from internalized racism or because he believed in this ideal of colorblindness, you know, that they will turn on it. And this is why I struggle with this notion that the social justice movement is a continuation of the civil rights movement, because I see it as very much reactionary against the civil rights movement.
Well, it's both. I mean, in the same way that the Reformation, of course, casts itself as an utter repudiation of everything that's gone before, but isn't, because it's part of it. It's a recalibration of it. And similarly with the Enlightenment, that, you know, I quote Voltaire in it, who's famously Scabrous critic of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
But who campaigns against injustices inflicted by the church for dogmatic reasons, as Voltaire sees it. But why is Voltaire so upset by this? Because the foundational image in a Catholic church is the image of someone being tortured to death on an instrument of torture. So the ways in which you think you're repudiating this Christian inheritance often shows how Christian you remain and how in debt to the legacy of what went before. And I think that the relationship of modern social rights campaigners to, say, the civil rights movement, and still more to Christianity more broadly, is the same. I think that it's, you know, it's kind of Oedipal relationship, perhaps, almost.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So then what do you make of the impulse as a historian? I think this is an interesting question for you. What do you make of this impulse within that movement to attempt to sanitize the past, to attempt to remove elements of the past? We've seen this in the sort of the toppling of the statues of people like Edward Colston and calls to topple statues of Mahatma Gandhi and Winston Churchill. So we just erase the history that is inconvenient rather than learning from it. I have a real problem with that. I have a real problem with the British Library Decolonizing Working Group talking about how they need to revisit their manuscripts and powerfully reinterpret their manuscripts. I have nothing against reinterpretation. I have a problem when I think the interpretation has been predetermined. I think they know what the outcome of that will be. And similarly, the idea of decolonizing studies of the classics, decolonizing studies of history. Are we not just imposing a modern cultish ethical trend onto history? And could that not have lasting damage to your discipline?
Well, I think that convulsive reevaluations of society and morality of the order of, say, the emergence of Christianity in the Roman Empire, the conversion of early medieval Europe, the Reformation, French Revolution, Russian Revolution, what's happening now, always kind of ripple backwards as well as forwards. Mm-hmm. And it reconfigures people's sense of what was acceptable in the past. So even though actually the kind of Gibbonian idea that all the temples of the ancient gods were ransacked by Christian evangelists isn't true, the Christian evangelists themselves said it was. I mean, it was something that they would have liked to believe was true. I mean, basically the temples just kind of crumbled in the way that a parish church now might crumble. But people wanted to believe that was true. Likewise, the Reformation was, you know, an absolute carnival of iconoclasm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of shocking. The sense of blasphemy, I mean, it's something that I feel quite strongly.
Yes.
And, you know, I was kind of raised, I was kind of Anglican agnostic. But the kind of the mockery of the Virgin, the mockery of the crucifixes, the mockery of the statues, I mean, it's really shocking. And I think that, you know, that's kind of very much the tradition of France. The Charlie Hebdo tradition goes back to that, to the kind of Huguenots, really. And then, of course, in the French Revolution and so on. So I think that it's not surprising that it's happening, because if you're judging contemporary society and finding it wanting, then you are going to judge and find wanting things that society in the past had felt to be acceptable. Now, I generally don't want things destroyed, because I think, you know, I deeply regret the fact that there aren't more Greek temples and more church, you know, paintings on the walls in English parish churches. And,
yes,
you know, I regret everything that was destroyed in the revolution. But I suspect that it's kind of like trying to hold back the tide at the moment.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here. I produce Culture Wars and all of Spike's podcasts. I really hope you're enjoying the show so far. This podcast, like all of Spike's content, is free. There's no paywalls or no paid subscriptions. We rely on the support of our loyal listeners and readers like yourself to keep producing our groundbreaking podcasts, interviews, articles, essays, and more. So, if you're a regular listener to this podcast and you're wondering how best to support it, please do consider donating to Spiked, or even better, becoming a regular donor. Even £5 per month can make an enormous difference. To start your regular donation today, just go to spiked-online.com and click the red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the red donate button in the top right corner. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
Well, that's the worry I feel, is that the momentum feels that you can't have a sensible discussion about it. I remember when the statue of Colston was being torn down, and James O'Brien on LBC was saying, however you feel about that statue is how you feel about slavery, which is palpably not true.
When I watched that happen, a part of me thought, I'm generally not in favour of statues being toppled and built-up heritage being toppled like that. But part of me thought, precisely the fact that it's illegal is kind of what makes it exciting. Mm-hmm. Because if it had been legally done, it wouldn't have had that kind of charge, that shock. And having written quite a lot about iconoclasm in the Reformation, it kind of gave me a dizzying sense of how exciting it must have been, and the kind of mingled sense of shock and thrill and excitement that people felt watching it. And I think that it The Colson statue, if it had been set up in when was he, 17th century, 18th century?
It was set up much later, yes.
So if it had been set up by, you know, grateful paupers who'd been rescued and they'd all chipped together their widow's mites and raised it.
Yes.
Then I think that's different because then who are we to...
Yes.
But because it was set up when it was by late Victorian imperialists who knew exactly what they were doing when they set it up. You know, they knew what he'd been involved with. Slavery had been abolished.
But you see, you're looking at the detail, a detail that is often missed by the very activists who want to see the statues toppled. I mean, we had this with the Abraham Lincoln Monument.
Yeah.
And this was something that had come from the freed slaves themselves. In fact, you had one of the descendants of the slaves saying, my great-great-great-grandfather put this up, raise money, how dare you want to tear this down? And that nuance is missed, I think, by the very people who have this kind of totalitarian instinct to erase and cleanse.
Well, I think that again, you see this in the Reformation and indeed the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, that once you get on a kind of iconoclasm kick, you're not really interested in the nuance.
No, because it's fun.
It's fun
I mean, to smash things up, right?
It's fun.
Basically,
it's kind of annoying, and the more annoyed people get, the more fun it kind of becomes. But I thought the Colston thing, I mean, I thought that was absolutely with the grain of kind of the English tradition of radical Protestantism. And to that extent, it didn't actually seem a total repudiation of culture. I mean, it seemed, you know, it seemed a kind of tight, you know, in a way, it's kind of older. It's an expression of an older tradition than that of setting up statues, which is basically an 18th century tradition.
I didn't have any particular fondness for that particular statue. I'm talking about the principle and the precedent, I suppose. That's what I mean.
So I guess that I think that where statues of slavers have been put up by people who knew that they were slavers and that slavery was wrong, so it was set up after the abolition of the slave trade.
Yes.
I don't feel, you know, I'd be very happy to see them come down. I think that that's morally wrong. But what I do think is that statues that are put up to celebrate the good things that people did, so the statue of Thomas Guy, who,
yes,
you know, I mean, he made some of his money, I think, by investing it in the various nefarious practices. But he used that money to build a hospital.
Yeah.
And who the hell are we to turn on the people who wanted to put that up to thank him?
So, I mean, actually, I think his was pretty tenuous anyway. Wasn't it an investment in a company that had invested in slavery? I mean, it wasn't even a direct link. And that kind of tenuous connection, which is what explains why the British Library putting Ted Hughes on a list, because some vague ancestor from 400 years ago had something to do with slavery. You know, I worry about where it leads, I suppose, is my point. I'm not so much worried about the odd, overzealous example of overreach every now and then. I'm worried about where that then ultimately takes us. And more broadly, in terms of your discipline, you know, I mean, you must have some feeling about this. If people say to you, well, the sources that you look at, you're going to have to rethink about whether the source is valid on the basis of their sexuality or race, because history is in fact simply about power struggles. It is simply about a will to power as manifested through texts and through art and through artifacts. And that surely affects your ability to assess and analyze history, doesn't it?
No, because I don't think anyone, I mean, you know, I live by whether people are willing to buy what I write. So I don't think that's a problem. And I think that it goes without saying that every periods of the writing of history evolve and change. And there will be certain periods where certain assumptions are kind of hardwired in and then they get challenged. And I'm sure that current assumptions in turn will be challenged. And so it goes on. I mean, one of the things that I actually find very exciting at the moment is that, you know, in the 60s, the 17th century, the civil wars and so on were kind of interpreted in Marxist terms in a way that now they never would be, because people recognize the significance and importance of religion in a way that simply wasn't the case. And I wonder whether that's because actually the kind of the echoes in the present of those periods are now so manifest it becomes almost impossible to deny them. So in a sense, when you see people topple a statue of a slaver, it makes it easier to understand what's happening in early modern Protestantism, I think. And I think that again and again, this is part of the fascination of history, is that it's kind of like a kaleidoscope, that things in the present happen and change and turn, and suddenly you understand dimensions of the past in a way that you hadn't previously done.
Well, I suppose what I'm talking about is the extreme form of iconoclasm that would see things destroyed so that we can't go back to them. I mean, you're talking about this, the sort of cycles of attitudes and history. But if, for instance, we take the view that Sheffield University have recently taken, and just in terms of my subject, they put out a video recently saying the only reason we study Shakespeare and Chaucer is because they were white men, and therefore they will offer a degree so you can have a degree in English literature without ever having read either. I think that does great damage to the student. I think it impoverishes the student. I think it has a kind of an elevating effect on culture, which is not easily clawed back, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Well, I think that if you assume that the only value of the humanities is to sit in moral judgment past and kind of lecture them and then put them on the naughty chair, then essentially that's, I think, intellectually quite impoverishing. And
but it's very, prominent.
Yeah, but it's prominent because it's fashionable.
Okay.
But I suspect that people will react against that because it will become very evident that actually you're not really learning very much. If, you know, you're doing an English literature degree and Chaucer and Shakespeare, if you don't get to study them, and it's not just because they're, you know, you might want to say, well, they are, you know, great poets. It's also the fact that they're kind of difficult and challenging.
It's
precisely the fact they're not like us. You know, the language is challenging. The ideas are understandable. I mean, it's kind of a brilliant one. I'm just reading this fantastic book on Milton at the moment about the making of Milton. Making of a radical poet. And it's about his educational process. And you know, the famous thing that he was the Lady of Christ's domina. And he kind of talks about this himself. And so huge excitement on kind of queer theory and all this kind of stuff. He's subverting gender stereotypes and all this kind of stuff. But the argument in this book, which seems to me a brilliant one, is that Milton's keen on this idea because Virgil very similarly had been described in those kind of terms because he'd been so devoted to the study of poetry and literature and so committed to it that he was described as being kind of maidenish, like a virgin.
Yes.
So Milton picks up on this because he wants to be like Virgil. And it's brilliant when you read that something that you think, oh, yes, of course, this is all about transgenderism or whatever. You know, it's Milton wanting to be a woman or whatever. And it's actually, it's so much more complicated than that because it's rooted in all kinds of weird stuff about Milton wanting to be Virgil and how the Romans understood Virgil and all this. And that's the fascination of it, isn't it?
Oh, it's great. But the thing about that is, because when I was at university, the queer theory thing was so fashionable. It was at a peak. And so therefore you would have like Donne's Holy Sonnets, you know, when he's talking about being ravished by God. And that would be reinterpreted as a kind of queer thing as well.
Because then it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, it's you know, it's exciting. And it kind of opens up because, of course, you know, with Milton, there is this kind of, you know, it is a subversion of gender stereotypes. It is kind of problematic.
Sure.
But, and so it's fun if no one has pointed that out to explore that. But then if that becomes the bedrock of it.
Yes, I suppose that's my point.
Then it becomes completely reductive. So again, I have confidence in the humanities that each orthodoxy will become dull to students and to scholars, and that they will want to move on because that's the way that it goes. I'd be optimistic about
great.
It.
I hope you're right. I suppose I just don't think you are because I see it as seeping too much into culture now. And like I'm all for people who want to study, say, critical race theory. I think it's fundamentally flawed as a discipline. I think it's fraudulent, but I think it's fine for people to study. I have no problem with that. My problem is when it becomes a dogma. That's my problem. And I think that's what you're seeing now.
Well, and of course, that brings us back to Christianity, which is that in the wake of the 60s, part of the excitement of doing humanities in literature or history or whatever was the feeling that you could throw off dogma and you could contemplate all kinds of radical new ways of, say, feminist, gay ways of seeing things. You know, you could enshrine the Marquis de Sade or, you know, I mean, all kinds, you know, huge vistas of opportunity open up because you've thrown aside the dogmas. Mm. And I think that, you know, I was at university in the late 80s, and then there was the feeling that who would ever want to hold a dogma? I mean, who would ever want to be circumscribed in what they could study or say by dogma and by rules? I mean, who would ever want that? And now, of course, you entirely see that, of course, there are all kinds of things that you can't say and stuff. But in a sense, it then becomes exciting because then you kick back against that.
Oh, well, it's exciting, but it's also exhausting.
I guess it is if you're fighting. But suddenly, you know, there's this kind of agonies that the many of the church fathers, Jerome famously, felt in their kind of ambivalent relationship to classical literature or Augustine, that they're worried that it's kind of often literally demonic, that, you know, if you love Virgil too much or Homer, then in some way you're untrue to Christ. And that kind of ambivalence in the moral attitude towards the classical inheritance runs all the way through the Middle Ages. It's still there in Milton. And I think that, again, part of what's happening now where you say, well, you shouldn't like Shakespeare because it's oppressive or whatever. And yet Shakespeare's so good, you want to read it.
Right.
You know, it kind of makes you have fellow feeling with Augustine or Jerome in a way that previously I would never have done.
That's very interesting. Actually, I wanted to ask you about this idea of your own affinity with historical figures and figures from the past. I mean, we're talking the way in which a lot of the current social justice movement will interpret or insist on interpreting the past in accordance with their own mindset, just their narrow worldview and how closely they match it. Do you find yourself having to guard against your own biases whenever you look back and assess these figures from the past?
Of course. And that's part of the reason that I ended up writing Dominion, was that I began to realize as I was trying to write about the Romans or the Greeks, that even the language I was using was saturated in assumptions that would have meant nothing to the people I was writing about. So to use a word like religion, to use a word like secular, to use a word like homosexual.
Yes.
These are words that are freighted with signification that, you know, it took me time to work out that basically they're all Christian. It's all Christian kind of signification, but it's shot through with assumptions that would have meant nothing to the Greeks and the Romans. And I feel that that when I look at the pre-Christian world, it's kind of like there's a smoke screen. I can see them dimly.
Yes.
But there's kind of a haze that is obscuring them, obscuring what I'm seeing.
Yes.
And in a sense, the challenge is to try and disperse that haze. But even to try and disperse that haze, in a sense, is marking you out as where you stand, you know, in the 21st century. Of course, it's impossible to escape bias. It's impossible to escape.
It does, because you're implying that your real goal is the truth, that you're not going to try and interpret things in accordance with how you would wish them to be, which is, of course, the exact opposite of what a social justice activist would do, which would be to say, oh, actually, this person was, you know, Orwell didn't mean that when he wrote 1984, or this person, or this didn't happen, even though it so palpably obviously did. And that's the difference, I think, in what you're doing.
Maybe, but I think that, well, I don't know, because when you sit in judgment on someone, we all have our biases. And so the fact that I would see that as a bias perhaps is my bias.
Right. Okay. Well, let me give you an example. I was recently, towards the end of last year, I went to Capri. I wanted to go and see Tiberius's villa, or what's left of it, at the top of the mountain.
It's quite a lot, isn't there?
There's actually more than you think, you know. Of course, they built a big church on top of it, and statue of the,
of course,
a big statue of the Virgin Mary, which was apparently there to sort of exorcise the demons of all the depravity that took place within those walls. But even still, you know, reading about it and even just the materials that were available there, the narrative seemed to be this man was an evil, decadent figure who retired to Capri because he wanted to indulge the most grotesque sexual fantasies involving children and babies and animals and whatever. And he wanted to indulge in murder and incest or whatever it was. And yet that's not true, is it? I mean, this has all come from Tacitus and Suetonius. And those narratives lasted for 2,000 years. But it's not true, is it? And that must have come from a moral judgment, I suppose, is what I'm saying. The historians who established the false narrative must have been, I mean, I don't know, you'll know more than I do about this.
Well, it's political. So Tiberius, who builds the villa on Capri and who has these terrible stories about him, what he gets up to, there are alternative raft of stories in which he's a kind of Prospero figure. He's the wise magician on his island who is infinitely wise, infinitely curious, has the profoundest knowledge of the workings of the gods of anyone in the world, who upholds peace across the span of the empire. And this is Greeks tell stories about him, Jews tell stories about him, fascinatingly Christians tell stories about him. So there's this kind of running thing in Tiberius that people will bring reports of wonders to him, and he will set up a commission to explore it. And this is obviously a running joke, because you get it. It's applied to the report of a merman in a cave outside Lisbon. It's applied to the discovery of giant bones that are clearly those of Pleistocene megafauna, but which are assumed to be giants. And then there's a story about how the apostles come to the Senate and report the news of Christ's death and resurrection. And the senators want to put them to death, but Tiberius says, no, let's set up a committee. Let's investigate this. And so you can see that this is quite an early story, and it's drawing on a whole tradition about Tiberius that has been obliterated.
Yes.
And the reason that those legends have survived is basically because the people who wrote the histories that survived were from the class that disliked very powerful emperors who they felt had disrespected the Senate.
Yes.
So it's kind of, I suppose it's like, and this is even more evident with I guess, figures like Caligula or Nero, who clearly were, let's say, problematic in a word, I'm sure, but who clearly weren't quite as problematic as Tacitus or Suetonius implies. And I guess it would be analogous to, you know, historians in 2000 years time only having the New York Times or CNN on Trump.
Right.
It's evident that Trump's done terrible things and in many ways is a kind of morally repugnant person. And yet you would want, I think, to have the counter view as well, to fully evaluate his reputation. But the problem with the records for Tiberius is basically that, you know, he got unlucky. The two definitive accounts were written by people who had reason to detest him.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, I've grown very conscious in recent years that we don't even know people who are alive today particularly well, and we make all kinds of assumptions. So how the hell you can possibly assess some long dead emperor? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you must feel a particular responsibility, because as that the example of Tacitus and Suetonius shows, if historians get it wrong, you could destroy someone. You can destroy the reputation of someone for a long time.
It's also the crimes for which Tiberius is most notorious are sexual ones. Mm-hmm. And again, this is why I wanted to write Dominion, was that the temptation is to assume that people's cultural understanding of sex is the same, but it isn't at all. I mean, it's so different. And the way that people conceptualize sex has evolved so profoundly. And again, I think that Christianity has been the key determinant and influence on this. Mm-hmm. But it means that to understand why, for instance, Suetonius is criticizing an emperor for his sexuality, you have to totally put aside the reasons why we might do it.
Right.
They're utterly different. And you kind of have to therefore get yourself into the mindset of a Roman before you can even begin to understand the different ways in which a Roman might kind of appreciate sexual morality. And that's part of the complexity of it, but of course it's also part of the fascination of it. And that's, you know, and that applies to morality as well. You know, that's part of why you could understand that someone could make an enormous amount of money from slavery and feel that God had blessed him by doing so, and that therefore he had a moral responsibility to set up orphanages.
Yes.
That it's not what to us in the 21st century would appear a stark moral failing in the context of, say, the early 18th century wouldn't necessarily, although to some it would, because to a Quaker, for instance, it probably would.
I suppose it's more fun to believe the worst of people, isn't it? I suppose that's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, that tends to be kind of reductive history or theology or literature if you do that.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Macbeth or Milton Satan are more interesting because there is moral complexity there.
Yes, of course.
And not just purely evil. I mean, you know, if you want to discover how boring just pure evil is, Marquis de Sade would be.
Oh, it's tedious, isn't it?
Incredibly dull.
Well, you know, it's a constant scatological nonsense. And at some point you think,
it becomes
please.
Quite funny, I suppose.
You know. It's funny if you dip in and out, I think. Yeah. But I think it does. Yeah. Even that can get boring. Doesn't that tell you quite a lot?
Yeah.
Variety is necessary. Listen, Tom, thanks so much for coming and chatting about these issues. It's been really good to talk to you. And just before we go, do you have anything you're working on now? Is there anything you want to let people know about? Or?
Well, I'm just trying to clear the decks. I've done translation of Suetonius for Penguin Classics, so that's why the crimes of Tiberius and Caligula are very much on my mind.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I just happened to raise that.
Yeah. So that's Penguin Classics, replacing the one by Robert Graves. So
blimey.
Very pleased with myself. And I'm just trying to clear the decks to start a new book on the Roman Empire. So I've done one on the fall of the Republic, one on the first emperors, Julia Claudians, and now I'm going to do one on the heyday of the empire. But it's kind of like fighting the Hydra. Every time I think I've cleared the deck, some new commission comes in.
Yes.
But I've got to try and start next week. So that's my target.
It's such a mammoth undertaking. I mean, the sheer scope of Dominion. I mean, how long did that take you to?
About 4 years to write that.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
A big project.
It's huge. And congratulations on it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It could be so much huger.
It could. But what I really liked about the way you did it is that you obviously 2000 years, such a big subject, but you really focus on these fascinating episodes and they're so well selected. The one that springs to mind is the thing about the Quaker, the abolitionist, Benjamin Lay, who talks about how slavery is as justifiable as thrusting a sword through the slave or thrusting it through the Bible. And then he does so, but he's put, what is it, pokeberry juice in the Bible. So the blood goes every, or this image of blood. I mean, it's so theatrical.
Well, you see, I mean, that's a fascinating, because he's in a way the kind of first activist. I mean, he's one of the very first activists. This is the big Quaker convention in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And he turns up with a Bible and demands that they condemn the slave trade, and none of the Quakers want to. And so he does exactly that. He holds up a Bible and he stabs it. And
amazing.
This spurt of juice looking like blood comes flooding out. But I mean, that's exactly the kind of spectacle that activists do now. And it's kind of amazing. You know, the line of descent there, I think, is very clear and fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, on that sacrilegious image, thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. You've been listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Tom Holland. If you enjoyed the show, you know what to do. Like and subscribe and make sure you don't miss any future episodes. And also, you should check out Tom's latest book, Dominion. I promise you, you won't regret it. Bye for now.